Welcome to The Aging Scientist, focusing on all things science and aging. I'm Clarissa Giebel, and I'm a researcher at the University of Liverpool, exploring inequalities in dementia care and aging. In this fourth season, I'll be tackling some of the basics of dementia. There is a lot to explore and discuss, but I hope the selection of topics will provide some key insights into dementia. I thought it would be apt to start off this season with what happens in the brain, often years before we actually notice anything in our day-to-day life. That's why I've invited Professor Selina Ray onto the show today. Selina is a Professor of Molecular Neuroscience and Alzheimer's Research UK Senior Research Fellow in the Department of Neurodegenerative Diseases at UCL. Selina received her degree in biochemistry and biological chemistry from the University of Nottingham in 2004, before undertaking PhD training in Dr. Diane Hanger's laboratory at the Institute of Psychiatry, King's College London. Selina was awarded her PhD in 2008 and then joined the laboratory of Professor John Hardy at UCL, eventually setting up her own lab there. Selina's work is focused on the use of induced pluripotent stem cell technology to model dementia, working closely with clinical colleagues to obtain samples from participants with rare genetic forms of dementia, and using these to understand the molecular basis of Alzheimer's disease and frontotemporal dementia. So welcome, Selina. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm really pleased to be here.
So we're usually having a lot of dementia care researchers on this podcast, as I mentioned. And so it's absolutely great to have someone from a more basic science background on the show. And I will learn a lot as well talking to you. So what made you interested in researching dementia in the first place?
It really started for me with an interest in the science, if I'm honest. So I have been, I guess I'm quite rare and very fortunate that I haven't experienced dementia within my family. But when I was at university, so as you said, I did biochemistry at university. And in the final 2 years, we had a lot of lectures about protein aggregation, and particularly when proteins go bad, I would say, which is a feature that characterizes all different forms of dementia. You get an abnormal buildup of certain proteins in the brain. And I just found this science really fascinating. So, you know, you mentioned that I work mainly on genetic forms of dementia. And to me, it still blows my mind that you can have one position within this protein that changes ever so slightly, and that is enough to completely change the way that protein will function or stop it from functioning altogether. And so I was really fortunate that I kind of had this interest. I thought I might like to spend some time doing research in this area. And I went to University of Nottingham. I worked in a lab there over the summer between my third and fourth year that really focused on protein aggregation in Parkinson's disease. And I just got the bug. I was like, you know, I love the theory of this. I love the actual hands-on science of doing this. And so that really motivated me to carry on with that. And so, as you said, that kind of gave me the groundwork to go on and do my PhD. That's when I really became aware that not only is the science interesting, but dementia is really understudied as a range of conditions. And there's a real unmet need to have more people doing research in this area, but also there's a chance to actually make a massive impact. And, you know, I still feel like there are massive gains that we can have in this area. And so that's where I sort of got carried along, wanting to do more research and build my research career, but actually also wanting to play a part in shaping policy and thinking in the field and being part of the community that campaigns for these conditions to receive more investment and more attention.
I think that's a really important point to mention. I think as researchers, there's this element, okay, we do our day-to-day job effectively, we're trying to find out new things, but then I'm the same, trying to make that impact, trying to work with people who are actually living with it or caring for someone. That's, for me, an equal part of the work that we do.
It really is. And I think, you know, I'm not clinically trained. I am a biochemist. And that means it would be quite possible for me to have done have a career in research. I got quite far into a research career without actually having met anyone who's living with one of these conditions or has it in their family. And there's something just a bit wrong about that, I think. You know, it's you know, not through anyone's fault. For me, I happen to have had those interactions because I'm at a research institute that is based alongside a clinical research program. It's because it's been facilitated by funders like Alzheimer's Research UK and Alzheimer's Society. So I've had the opportunities to do that. But, you know, I can't imagine, I don't think I'd be as motivated as I am unless I really knew the impact that it was having on people's lives. And I think it's also, I would very much say as a scientist, the thing that really I enjoy about my job is the variety. And so being in the lab and having the kind of research is really important to me, but I like all the other aspects of the role as well, whether that's interacting with patient groups, you know, going along to events in Parliament or fundraising to kind of lobby for that attention. And I think it's really having that involvement across the spectrum that I really enjoy.
I think it places things much more into context, doesn't it? Like in this field or any other research, to really then talk to people. So because you're working in a lab environment in your day-to-day work, how do you involve people living with dementia or carers then? Because I suppose from social care research, it's more talking to people or doing surveys, for example. So how does it work in a lab environment?
We have several ways that we kind of interact with patients and research participants. First of all, I should say that what I'm doing now with the stem cells is absolutely reliant on people who have been willing to participate in research, and really grateful for that. That has been mainly coordinated through my clinical colleagues who have spent years kind of working with multiple generations of families where there are rare kind of inherited forms of dementia. Although I'm not involved in kind of participant recruitment and actually taking the samples, it's really important for me that people have an idea of what we're doing with these samples and what we hope to achieve with the thing, the kind of tissue that they donate. And so I've spoken, you know, quite often at the different patient support groups that we have organized around UCL. So we have a familial Alzheimer's disease support group, a familial frontotemporal dementia support group, that I've had the opportunity to go and speak to the audience. And that's been really, it's you know, I learn a lot as well, because you learn about the experience of these people, you learn about what motivates them to kind of participate in research. But also it's really important that the identity of people who contribute to our research is protected. So I don't know, you know, within the audience, I know that some people will have contributed cells that I'm working with, but I don't know who. And so I think it's really kind of nice for me to have an opportunity to say, we've collected these samples, this is what we're doing with them, this is why we can't do this work in other ways. And, you know, this is why they're so precious. And also, this is kind of the timeline that we're working with. I think that's one thing that's really crucial in the lab-based science, is what I would class as rapid progress doesn't always translate to rapid progress that has benefit to the patient, right? So interest in science for me is still a long way, perhaps, from clinical benefit. So actually being able to give context for that, I think, is really important. Beyond those kind of very interested groups, we kind of do a lot of work with the public more broadly through events like Pint of Science, which is really engagement. We've been to the Science Museum to get people looking down the microscope at cells, which is really good. And I was also really privileged to be part of a project called Created Out of Mind, which was more around involvement rather than engagement. So we were working with several artists, one of whom I continue to work with now, but doing things like running art-based workshops where, you know, people who were living with these conditions, you might find it difficult to perhaps communicate through a conversation, can still express themselves through these kind of art platforms. And how can that really influence our research in terms of co-creation? So I would say, you know, I've done a lot of engagement, and the challenge that I'm still working on is how do we move that more towards active involvement? Because I appreciate that they are different things. But it's something that I get a lot of kind of enjoyment out of, is especially when people think of lab-based science as being quite complicated. And when you explain something and maybe strip away some of the jargon that we use, you can see some of the ideas click. And that's really satisfying when I think, yeah, you get it as well, you know, if that makes sense.
And I can fully agree, not from a lab point of view, but from kind of the more applied health research point of view. There's something very enjoyable about engaging with people that are affected by it, but also the general public, just to try and raise awareness of it, isn't it? So it seems like you're doing a lot of that on different platforms, which is fun. So going back to your research, when I introduced you, I introduced you that you're focusing particularly on Alzheimer's disease and frontotemporal dementia. You mentioned that genetic focus as well. Can you tell us a bit more, and why are you looking at those two subtypes specifically?
Absolutely. So if I start, first of all, by addressing why we're looking at genetic forms of dementia. So these are incredibly, when I talk about genetics, I'm talking about a specific subtype called autosomal dominant forms of disease. And what that means is if one of your parents has the disease, you have a 50% chance of inheriting that gene. And if you do inherit that gene, it's highly likely that you will get the disease too. It accounts for less than 1% of Alzheimer's disease. So it's a very rare population. The people who do carry these genes tend to develop the disease very early compared to the kind of late onset forms. And it also is a bit more aggressive because there's a genetic driver within those people. Now, the reason that we are interested in these genetic forms of diseases is twofold. First of all, we know absolutely within that individual what causes their disease. And for the majority of people with Alzheimer's or frontotemporal dementia, we don't know that. It's a combination of kind of different factors. But when someone has these inherited forms, we know it's this faulty copy of a gene that is causing them to develop the disease. The second reason why that we're interested in these particular subgroups is even though the causes may be different, the changes that are happening in the brain at the cellular level are very similar between genetic forms and late onset forms. And so our idea is really that these genetic forms are giving us a window into a process, but that process is still relevant to the disease as a whole.
Okay. So when you talk about genetics, specifically, is it the frontotemporal version you were referring to? Yeah.
Actually, for both Alzheimer's and frontotemporal dementia, there are causative genes. And so the reason that I am interested in both of these diseases is I said right at the beginning that I was interested in protein aggregation. And there is a protein called tau that is found to accumulate in the brains of people both with Alzheimer's disease and with some forms of frontotemporal dementia. And so the reason that I'm interested in both AD and FTD is because we know the tau protein is important for both diseases, but actually probably in slightly different ways. And so by studying both of the diseases, it helps us to get a kind of more complete picture of what is going wrong with the tau protein.
Okay, so that's fascinating. So when you talk about those particular genetics form, is there a different frequency in between genders? So between males and females, have you noticed that?
For the genetic forms, I don't believe there is. I know within the kind of broader late onset disease, Alzheimer's in particular tends to have a bit of a higher prevalence in women. Mm-hmm. But for the genetic forms, I don't believe there is any gender difference.
Okay. So my own research has looked more at the symptomatic point of view. So how able people are, for example, to initiate or perform activities. So managing your finances, cooking, getting dressed, and all these things deteriorate differently in Alzheimer's and frontotemporal. So that's kind of my understanding from it. And you come at it from a different complementary side. So I know, therefore, that there are different areas of the brain that are affected and deteriorate in these subtypes. And you've kind of referred to that now with the tau protein. So what precisely happens on a really microscopic level then in those subtypes?
A big question. So in, let's start with Alzheimer's disease as an example. So we know in the brain of somebody who has Alzheimer's disease that the buildup of tau appears in different parts of the brain at different times. And this really is closely correlated with the severity of that person's symptoms. So for example, the part of the brain where tau accumulation starts to occur is the entorhinal cortex. You know, at the point where the tau pathology is only in the entorhinal cortex, the person will actually have no symptoms, but it will then spread throughout the brain and kind of through the cortical regions of the brain. And so this is why quite often the presenting symptoms are associated with memory. Not always. I know this won't apply to everyone who's lived with Alzheimer's, but if we look at kind of the majority of cases, the people with Alzheimer's will have a memory-led disease. Now, in frontotemporal dementia, as the name suggests, the pathology is occurring in the frontal and temporal lobes. And this will then manifest itself in slightly different ways. So this could be with personality changes, such as the person becoming more aggressive, becoming withdrawn, becoming apathetic. And so you can see that the diseases are different based on where the cells of the brain are affected. Mm-hmm. We don't, you know, in Alzheimer's disease, the progression that I just described is known as Braak stage into after the neuropathologists who first describe it. And it's really kind of well mapped out where it starts and how it progresses. In frontotemporal dementia is much more of a diverse group of different pathologies. And so we don't quite have the same kind of map, perhaps, that we have of the Alzheimer brain. And one thing that we don't understand very well at all, I would say, is what causes those different brain regions to become vulnerable and why, what is the trigger, if you like, in different diseases.
So you're just you've just highlighted that there are different areas of the brain that get affected to a different extent in those two example subtypes, with Alzheimer's being the most common dementia subtype. Do you know where, or are you looking to in any aspect of your work, whether there are any tests, diagnostic tests, to get this maybe diagnosed earlier than it is taking place at the moment?
It's not really my work. What I do is related because we're using cell models to try and kind of understand the earliest stages, but that's not really at the point where it could be used for testing at the moment. However, there are some, I think, really exciting developments in the field. One of them that is really kind of quite a big breakthrough is the ability to image tau in the brain while somebody is still alive. So the development of specific ligands that someone can, I think, maybe, I don't know if they drink them or injected, I don't know, but will then bind to the tau. And so when that person has a PET scan, you can see different brains, regions of the brain light up. PET scans are incredibly expensive. And so although they're showing a lot of promise in research, it's not something that could be rolled out widely at the moment. But where I think the kind of second really exciting area is potentially the development of blood tests for Alzheimer's. Specifically, Alzheimer's is where most of the work has happened here, but that they could still be valuable for FTD. And so we can already measure quite accurately in the blood a different protein called amyloid, which is also involved in Alzheimer's disease. And the tests for looking at tau in the blood are really under development. I think there are kind of two questions here that will govern how successfully they translate to clinics. So I think being able to measure tau is one thing, but it's quite general. So would that be a marker of a specific diagnosis such as Alzheimer's or frontotemporal dementia? And I think it's only when you kind of have a panel of markers that allows you to kind of distinguish between the diseases that we really hit the gold standard of what we're aiming for. But it's really, I mean, it is really exciting because a blood test can be done anywhere. It doesn't rely on being close to a teaching hospital, for example, and specialist equipment. And it's also much, much cheaper. So even if, you know, a subgroup of individuals might eventually need that PET scan anyway, the blood test might help to stratify groups somewhat. So I think, you know, it's a bit removed from what I'm doing. So I sort of keep half an ear to those papers, but it just seems that's where there's been a ton of progress recently.
So from your work, I know this is a bit outside of your comfort zone, but looking at those amyloid and tau proteins, are they building up so early that you could get a blood test or something similar, possibly years before you get a normal diagnosis? Is something like that potentially possible?
Potentially, I think so. I mean, we know from brain imaging scans and from post-mortem studies that particularly in Alzheimer's disease, there's pathology is developing potentially decades before somebody has their symptoms. So actually, you know, exactly what you said is really important. If we can detect that pathology at the early stages, then when we do have the treatments that will hopefully slow that down or stop it, we will be able to identify exactly who we need to give them to.
Yeah. Now, that's been a really more detailed elaboration of what happens in the brain, which is what I was after. But what if someone comes up to you on the street or in a coffee shop and asks you, "Hi, Selena, what happens in the brain when you get dementia?" What would you tell that person?
I would tell them, first of all, that dementia isn't a single entity, which is something we already discussed a little bit. And I would say, you know, dementia is really describing a group of symptoms. Those symptoms are caused by diseases of the brain, of which the most common one is Alzheimer's disease. But there are others. There's frontotemporal dementia, there's vascular dementia, and others besides. And then I would say in those diseases, what is happening is that the cells within the brain, specifically a cell type called neurons, are dying over time. So the diseases are all progressive, which means they get worse over time. The symptoms are caused by the death of cells in the brain, and the particular symptoms that a person has are kind of governed by where that cell death is happening. So which region of the brain is affected will then dictate what type of symptoms a person has.
I'm sure that person would walk away knowing much more. So.
Hopefully.
So from all your research so far, what would you say has been the most unexpected or interesting finding?
Oh, gosh. I mean, we've still got a few little things that I won't talk about just because we have no idea why yet. So interesting observations that we think, well, you know, well, how are we going to get to the bottom of this? I think what has been, so I had a bit, this is why talking to patient groups and hearing about the patient experience is so valuable, because I have to confess that I did not really fully appreciate that even within genetic forms of Alzheimer's disease, there is quite a lot of variability in symptoms that people have. And actually, with a particular gene that we work on called presenilin 1, quite a high number of individuals do not have a memory-led presentation. They might present with something a bit more like even movement changes, for example. So this kind of surprised me. And what has been really fascinating is that we see that reflected at the molecular level. So we are working with patients from cells who carry the faulty genes, and we look at their kind of cellular profiles and are they different from people who, first of all, who don't carry the gene? And that's very clear. But what we're starting to appreciate now is that there are even differences within the group. So people might have, when I say faulty gene, mutations are a bit like spelling mistakes in the gene. So within the same gene, there can be different people will have different errors. And we're even seeing differences between people who have a fault in the same gene, but a slightly different one. And so that, for me, is really fascinating. If I extrapolate those findings to what I would like to understand, this, I should stress, this is speculative at the moment, But I think it would be fascinating if we could look at someone's cellular profile and say, based on the kind of molecular makeup of these cells, this person is more likely to have kind of this symptomatic profile. That for me would be really powerful, because in the lab, I think for until we were able to work with these stem cells, we always had a bit of a disconnect that, you know, genetics, pathology, imaging, biomarker research, care research, all happening with the patient. And we had to look for other models because we just couldn't grow human brain cells in the lab. Whereas now I feel we've got a real opportunity to sort of bridge that gap and say, well, actually, we can look in cells from different people, and we can link what we see potentially back to that individual's disease. So that was a very long way of saying personalized medicine is what I'm excited about. And, you know, it is speculative. We're at the beginning of a long journey, but I think the potential is there. So it's really exciting.
Definitely. I agree, though. It'd be interesting because, especially in research, we're always told be interdisciplinary. But we also need to be much more interdisciplinary within dementia itself, I think, sometimes. And there shouldn't be that clear division at times between basic research and care research. It feels a bit divided at times, doesn't it?
Yeah, I really agree. And I've benefited hugely from being co-located with clinical researchers who a lot of what we see in the cells, we wouldn't fully understand unless we had them to kind of put that into context. And what I see at UCL as well is, you know, people are really, you know, from what I see as kind of someone on the periphery, people are really cared for. I mean, as I mentioned, my clinical colleagues have worked quite often with multiple generations of these families. Mm-hmm. And as well as the research we do, they're now thinking, how can we tailor care to people who are living with care and support, should I say, to the people who are living with these rare, really rare conditions? And, you know, I think that's why I like to do my bit and at least try and bring them along on the journey of what I'm doing with the cells a little bit. But yeah, we've got to, you know, we have to all work together, because in fact, when people are given a huge amount to kind of enable our research, we've got to make sure that we maximize what we can get with that really precious resource and give as much back as we possibly can.
Absolutely. So let's do some research together, Selena.
Yeah, collaboration.
So we spoke a bit about your lab work in particular, but I'm just wondering, how has the pandemic affected your lab? So you run your own lab at the university. What's it been like? Have you been able to go in at all? Or
it's been really, really tough. So the work that we do, the kind of timeline for experiments we do is usually about a 3 to 4 month turnaround, because that's how long it takes the cells to grow and mature. And so when the first lockdown hit, we, like everyone else, pretty much shut down the lab and we were all staying at home. You know, we had things to do. We were writing review papers, writing grants, things like that. But it was really, really stressful, particularly for PhD students, for example, who are on a fixed timeline. They didn't know when they were going to get back in the lab, didn't know how it would actually alter the long-term course of their PhD. And so that has been, you know, it's been really stressful for the group. When things started to reopen, again, I think this is pretty typical of what most places did. We reopened in a stepwise fashion. So we started just at 25% capacity for, I think that was for about 3 months, stepped it up to 50% capacity. And now we're pretty much back to 100%. And hopefully it will stay that way. But I would say it set us back between 6 and 9 months, because you've got the 3 months that we were shut completely, but then even when we reopened, there's kind of a 3 to 4 month lag while we wait for things to get back up and running again. I'm really proud of how my lab have kind of coped with it and got things back up and running. I mean, they've done an amazing job, but obviously it's had an impact, and more broadly it's had an impact on the field in terms of fundraising and funding that's available as well. So I think things are starting to recover. Grant calls are reopening, but we built up, you know, the field of dementia has spent the last, 10 years really thinking about building momentum, building capacity. And it's amazing how quickly that was sort of taken away, hopefully temporarily. And I think now more than ever, it's affected research universally, no matter what people are working on. But I think now more than ever, we really need to say, look, we can't afford to lose this momentum and lose the people that we brought into the field.
Absolutely. I found I was absolutely stressing when the announcement was made about the lockdown, because in our research, we usually go out face-to-face, do interviews, do neuropsychology assessments, surveys, all these types of things, observations. No, you can't do that anymore. So within a week or two, we had to suddenly rethink, okay, let's do everything remotely. We can still collect data, but it was a very steep learning curve to get adjusted to that. But yeah, it's been an intense 2 years, hasn't it?
It feels adapt. So weird. I don't know if this is kind of just a way of coping, but it almost feels like a lifetime ago. But then you know, someone asks a question like that and you think about it a bit more in depth and you think, wow, yeah, that happened, right? And it was something that we didn't see it coming. I remember us being in the lab the week before saying, no, they won't shut us down. And then at the beginning saying, oh, you know, probably 3-4 weeks, I'm sure that's all it will be. And yeah, it's been an experience, hasn't it? But you know, I think, you know, we've all come out of it all right, and we've all, speaking about my lab here, you know, we've come out of it all right. The experiments are back up and running, and although it's been difficult, we absolutely acknowledge that there are a lot of people who have had much worse situations as well. Yeah. So hopefully we can just pick up and kind of build that momentum again.
Absolutely. And picking up on you running your own lab, okay, so it must have been difficult kind of managing that as well, managing your students and all your staff. But more in general, your work has already been recognized pretty well. For example, you've got the David Haig Early Career Investigator Award of the Year from Alzheimer's Research UK a few years ago. In addition to running your own lab, and you've made it to professor status at quite a young age, I must highlight here to our listeners. It's great to see a female professor at a young age. It's always something to look up to. So those are absolutely amazing achievements. And I've seen on social media as well, you're really a strong support for more women in science and women making these moves upwards. What advice would you give to girls or students or junior researchers out there to try and make it in science?
Oh gosh, it's again a big question. I think the first thing that really helped my mindset and helps my mindset a lot still is actually just acknowledging that a lot of the barriers are structural, right? And so it's not necessarily that we need to change or we need to do things differently. It's that actually the system needs to change. And I found that you can look at that one two ways. It can be a bit crushing when you think, you know, this is how on earth are we going to change the system? But I actually find it quite freeing, because I think, well, actually, I don't need to modify, you know, I shouldn't need to modify myself to kind of fit within a certain box. Things that have been helpful to me, I would say, are mentoring, and that completely contradicts what I've just said, because mentoring is kind of about changing the person, right? Rather than changing the system. But when I say mentoring, I have a few trusted individuals, kind of more senior scientists, people from outside of research, who are just really good as a sounding board and really good in helping, not telling me what to do, but helping me navigate certain decisions, or, you know, when is it the right time to apply for a promotion, things like that. I think it's useful to have someone who knows the process. So again, I think, as well as a woman, I'm like first gen and from quite an underprivileged background. So I think you need those allies who will tell you all of the unwritten rules about whatever industry you're in. So mentoring has been really important. More important than that, I think, is having sponsorship. And that's the other thing that I would say to people, is do not confuse mentoring with sponsorship, because actually the thing that has been hugely valuable to me is having people who I know have a seat at the table in meetings where things like tenure or promotions are decided, who know me, who know my work, and will, you know, be the ones who speak up for me. And so I would say to people, find sponsors. The question then is, how do you find them? And I would say, you know, don't be scared to ask. I think, you know, so the David Hague Award is a good example of this. It's one where you self-nominate. So I thought, why, nothing to lose? Like, why is it? It feels, I think there's a lot of awkwardness around self-nominating for awards, but to me, it's just the same as a grant application. High chance you won't get it, but you definitely won't get it unless you put your name down, right? But that needs a letter of support from someone. And so I went to my head of department and said, will you support me going forward for this? He had to write a letter or a statement. And so I didn't write it for him, but I then said, look, here are the things from my CV that I'm going to highlight in my application in case they're useful prompts for you. And I think don't be embarrassed to do that either, because the way I see it is that people who I'm asking to give me letters of support or references are probably being asked for that by loads of different people, and they can't possibly remember everyone's CV, right? So I think actually just giving a few bullet points and saying, use these if they're helpful, ignore them if they're not, I don't see that there should be any shame or embarrassment about that. So yeah, I guess that find mentor sponsors and just be a bit shameless, like don't be scared to go for things, because, you know, no one, people aren't going to turn around and hand things to you. I think so, in the way you've got to, I phrased that quite badly. That's not really what I meant. I meant kind of put your, like, show your deck of cards, if you like, and make it easy for people, as easy as possible for people to support you.
Yeah, I wouldn't even call it shameless. It's just about trying to push yourself out there, isn't it? Consistently having to go out there, because we know as you just mentioned, we barely get any funding. It's like 1 out of 10 or something, if that.
So it is. And I think, you know, I'm also really keen to acknowledge, even though I've talked about kind of some of the difficulties, I'm also keen to acknowledge the privilege I have. You know, I'm based at UCL, where dementia research is one of our biggest areas, and it would be a lie to say that that doesn't help, right? So I think it's kind of, you know, looking at what is on your side, where you can maybe put yourself out there and make your case a bit stronger. But just remembering that, you know, there are, as I say, a lot of the issues are structural as well as, and can't be fixed by fixing a person or changing how a person is. So do as much as you can, but also just, appreciate that there are some things that are out of control as well.
Absolutely. I would echo all of those points. It's just about persevering, isn't it? And trying to do as much as we can.
It is. And I would say for most people who are developing a career in research, probably have fairly good perseverance skills anyway. It's a kind of job skill that I think comes in useful more broadly.
Should be on the job description. Thank you so much, Selena. I think that's all we've got time for today. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I've learned a lot as well about what happens in the brain and dementia, so thank you. And if you want to learn more about the Selena Ray Lab and Selena's research, have a look at the bio with more details. And for more discussion into the basics of dementia, have a listen to my next few podcasts. Goodbye. Thank you, Selena.
Thank you.